Hello, listeners, and welcome to issue 236 of the Sudbury News Talk magazine. I'm Julie Thompson, and this edition is my second foray into presenting. By the time you listen to this recording, the European Football Championship and Wimbledon may have finished. I wonder who won. As July progresses swiftly towards the school holiday season, it turns one's mind to the memories of a childhood summer holiday and makes us all yearn, as adults, to get away, or at the very least, out for the day. As your presenter, it remains my privilege to select the topic for this edition, and this time I've chosen Sun, Sea and Sand, or Special Places in Suffolk. Let's open with a brand new contributor, Jackie McSweeney, who's taken on the mantle of Sun, Sea and Sand. Welcome, Jackie.
Hello everyone, this is my debut to the magazine. My name's Jackie. I do hope you enjoy some of my chatter. Please let me know what you think. If I'm a bit boring or ramble too much, then I can adapt for the next time. If indeed I'm allowed back. Well, the next 5 minutes will seal my fate. So here goes. I'm going to talk about sun, sea and sand, our topic for this month. I've a group of friends with whom I've enjoyed holidays home and abroad for some 22 years. Our numbers vary, up to 10 of us, but there's a core of six who attend most years. We know each other pretty well, and although not meeting up frequently, when we get together, it's like we only saw each other yesterday. This year, Croatia was the lucky country to win our favour. I'd never been before, insisting we go as I'd missed the first Croatian tour some 4 years earlier due to my niece's wedding. Family first, eh? The group WhatsApp was quickly established and imaginatively entitled Croatia 2024, really an undersell of the delights that were ahead. Six women, four over 70 and 169, and me, the baby, who volunteered to do all of the driving as insurance costs soar for the over 70s. Shocking. Fortunately, this got me out of most of the organising, but fear not, with two alpha females vying for supremacy, there was little need for the remaining four of us to join in. We're all very used to the friendly bickering, miscommunications and begrudging apologies between the two alphas. It's all part of our enjoyment. And this year the WhatsApp were full. What do you mean? I told you all, so read above. I'm only asking one more time, then I'm making a decision. You kind of get the idea. Supremely organised, with almost military precision, the Airbnb villa booked, car hired, lifts to the airport arranged, check-in and boarding passes printed, lunch for the journey purchased along with four special offer bottles of gin from the duty-free. Then the flights, pick up the car, maps, drop off at the Airbnb and then back to the supermarket for a week's supply of food in one trolley and then obviously the booze in the other. The angst of the organisers was balanced by some of the calm of the followers. It was a dreamy location, a villa set on the edge of the sea, about 20 minutes north of Dubrovnik. Our only neighbours, a family of three children, parents and grandparents, who would fish from the end of their pier. Our own bedrooms, for a bit of privacy, were poorly occupied, just for sleep. Absolute bliss. We spent all the mornings and nearly every evening outside on the veranda, drinking, eating and looking out to the beautiful blue Adriatic Sea or at the glittering lights of sparkling off the midnight waters. The daytimes, however, were a bit busier. Enjoying a country's heritage, we included two visits to Dubrovnik, courtesy of the owner's great-uncle, a retired merchant seaman who travelled the world and was only too happy to share the culture of the Croatians, their education, healthcare, as well as sanitation, winters, wild boar hunting, and the names and location of all of his family. I have to say, Dubrovnik didn't disappoint. A walk around the old city wall with the warm sea air blowing, knowing it was some 15 degrees cooler at home with continual rain. Oh. A visit to three or four museums exploring art, ethnography, pharmacology, and the War of 1991. A cracking lunch on one of the visits, and then just for two of us, a trip up in the cable car revealed the mountain range behind the great city and some breathtaking views of the city below, with the sea and its islands bobbling about in the shades of the blue sea. One evening, we sat around making a pretty good dent in the gin and wistfully staring out to sea as the sun disappeared over the mountain. About 1,000 metres away, the mountain's river released its cool, fresh water into the sea. And unbeknownst to us, the local fishermen knew of this rich source of a variety of fish. We thought that fishing in the dark with spotlights must be a local thing, perhaps when it was cooler. And we tried to eliminate all other random possibilities, like the local police dredging for a body. I have to say, it was just before Michael Mosley had been discovered, so our imaginations were rife and partially gin-fuelled. The next day, our Airbnb host brought us some fresh apple strudel and told us that what we'd witnessed were poachers and she'd report it. Hey, people are people the world over. Antonio, the son of the owner, had a little boat company of four boats. As it turned out, the house we stayed in was originally the boatyard where her husband's grandfather had built boats. Antonio met us and we agreed the date for a trip to the three Elafiti Islands. On the day, the skipper, Luvro, was the first person we'd met who wasn't a family member. In his early 20s, he was studying to be a merchant seaman, inspired by the great uncle. But he'd got a bit bored with the same three islands and said the last one just wasn't worth a visit. Alpha, too, messaged Antonio. When we hit the second island, she wanted confirmation. The first island, Colosept, was quaint, with a little church, and we found a tortoise, some flowering cacti, and lots of iridescent green beetles. The second island was designed for tourists. A large fake pirate ship with a disappointing beach area. We set off walking towards the beach, the other side of the island, in the midday sun. Mad dogs and Englishmen came to mind as the frustrations and tensions rose to a feisty spat where two of us refused to go any further. Alpha One, built like a svelte gazelle, saw no issue with walking a few more kilometres, but the one waiting for her knee replacement and the other with a recent hip replacement had other ideas. A rather entrepreneurial couple of men had set up an island transport with old golf buggies. We jumped on and trundled quite a distance that even Alpha One had to admit she wouldn't have liked to walk in the heat. Michael Mosley's discovery was a sad reminder of the risks of dehydration. Arriving at the other beach, I felt like a granny in a Victorian bathing costume, surrounded by luscious couples wearing some bits of string loosely attached to their sun-blessed bodies. It didn't stop us getting into the cool, clear water for a cooling off, though. It was a beautiful bay, and I was young once. A buggy ride back, and Luvro had received some very strict instructions to take us to the third island and anything else we asked for. Poor chap had had it both barrels. The third was a sweet little fishing area, quite authentic, locals sitting on old benches passing the time of day. We didn't spend too much time, and Luvro then had the benefit of feedback from Alpha One. This was our best island, she told him. In his defence, he did say that other tourists hadn't liked it. A bit boring, they said. But I guess he tended to play to a younger audience. Louvre wasn't done, though. And with one more trick up his sleeve, he opened a bottle of the local wine on the way back. Then another. And one more. By the time he dropped us off at the jetty, we were all hugging like the best of friends, wishing him the very best for his future. Finally, it wasn't until the last day that we discovered we'd gone out in one of our grandfather's original boats, making the magic of family and history come full circle. I'm sorry I have to stop here, as it's time up, and I'm sure you don't want to hear about the Game of Thrones house in Tyrol, just up the coast. Or do you? Well, maybe next time. Thanks for listening.
What a fabulous first article, and what a great writing style and radio voice. I do hope Jackie enjoys listening back to this edition and will become one of our regulars. So, after a new contributor, let's return to an old favourite. Not so much of the old, I hear him cry. It's over to our regular long-distance correspondent, Ken Watkins.
I grew up in Coventry, about as far away from the sea as you can get in the UK. And as a child, I delighted in those occasional glimpses of sun sparkling on the water, the chance of a swim in the sea, building sandcastles, eating ice cream and chips on the beach. The perfect day trip, which could never be spoiled, even when the sun refused to appear. Day trips meant Skegness, the nearest seaside resort, and a few hours on a coach together with a load of other excited children. And if we fell asleep on the way home, proof surely that the day, whatever the weather, had been exciting and enjoyable. And during the Coventry holiday fortnight, when all the car factories closed in the summer, a week away on the Isle of Wight, somewhere else on the south coast, or at a resort in Lancashire or North Wales, meant you didn't have to cram all the excitement into a few hours. But while there were other things to be enjoyed, the beach and the sea were always the main attractions. Many years later, living by the sea, as I do now in Barry, I'm well aware this scenario hasn't really changed. Summer here in Wales means day trippers on coaches from as far away as Birmingham, thanks to the motorway network, school trips from the valleys, and the inevitable weekend exit from Cardiff, and lots of happy children on the beach. And even at the height of summer, it's rarely too hot, as it's always possible to find a sea breeze. Unlike our most recent holiday abroad, where 40 degrees was normal, and for me, far from enjoyable. Global warming. It's going to be staycations from now on. I moved to Barry from Suffolk 4 years ago. A few years earlier, after retiring, we bought a house in Barry, my wife's hometown, so moving there was always a long-term aim. We'd lived there before for 7 years, when our children were very young, and I worked in Cardiff. Then, with a son Chris, aged 4, and a daughter Sue, not quite 2, when we moved to Barry, the beach and the sea inevitably played a large part in our lives. But not just one beach. Barry Island itself was, always, and remains, the main attraction for out-of-towners. Residents know there are 4 other beaches in the town, where you don't have to be shoehorned into a spot. Check out Gavin and Stacey if you really want to see how crowded it can get on the island's golden sand. Not that we resisted the temptations of Barry Island when our children were young. The added ingredients of an excellent fairground and the opportunity of a day pass for the Butlins Holiday Camp and its attractions made it a magical place for the children. The fairground is still there, but now there are houses where the holiday camp once stood. Back then, as I worked nights in Cardiff on the sports desk of the Western Mail newspaper, I was able to spend days on the beach with our children, carefully avoiding weekends, when space on the sand and in the car parks was at a premium. My son and I would happily spend plenty of time in the sea, although the other half of the family were not quite so keen. Nowadays, I'm content to walk by the sea rather than immerse myself in it. Barry is situated at the mouth of the Severn estuary, and the water quality has declined in recent years. Sadly, there are warning notices on some of the beaches spelling out that a surface which sparkles in the sunshine is hiding what lies beneath. That's just one of the many changes Barry has seen since I first got to know the town more than 50 years ago. But one thing remains constant. When we have visitors, we invariably end up, at their request I might add, enjoying fish and chips down the island. Somehow, the magic of sun, sea and sand, and those lovely childhood memories, combine to make those fish and chips the best in town.
Barry Island, Butlins and fish and chips sounds an ideal childhood for your family. Thank you, Ken. Time for our News Talk quiz now with the marvellous Michelle Mandry at the helm with another set of brain-draining questions for you. Over to Michelle.
Hello. Let's just jump straight in with number one. In what surprising type of vehicle did a young football fan arrive at his school leavers prom recently? Number two. According to the old proverb, what does not signify the arrival of summer? Number three, in which seaside town did Billy Butlin open his first holiday camp in 1936? Number four, cucumber is known for its refreshing qualities, but what percentage of it is water? Number five, and a follow-up question, is the cucumber a fruit or a vegetable? Number six, what connects the market town of Sudbury to Walt Disney and the tinsel town of Hollywood? Number seven, Sudbury Rowing Regatta, I'll say that again, Sudbury Rowing Club is celebrating which anniversary this year? Number eight, Paris is hosting the 2024 Olympic Games, but where will the surfing event take place? Number nine, tree plantations that line many riverbanks in East Anglia supplied the wood for which type of sporting equipment? And number 10, what traditional dessert is made from slices of bread, sugar and berries?
Thank you, Michelle. We look forward to hearing from you later with the answers. As you know, we like to have a guest in every edition, and this time is no exception. You might have noticed we've all been very careful to pronounce all our words correctly so far. I wonder if that has anything to do with the person I'm about to introduce. We are delighted to welcome Kevin Northcott, president of the Sudbury Speakers Club, who will explain how the club helps people gain confidence communicating with the spoken word.
Thank you for the welcome, Julie. And thank you for the opportunity to explain how our club helps individuals to build their knowledge and confidence, as few skills can impact your life in the positive way that learning to speak in public does.
Please begin, Kevin, by telling us a little bit about your club.
We are a member of the Association of Speakers Clubs, an organisation providing a well-defined development pathway which enables you to develop both your speaking and leadership skills through a multitude of ways. We have clubs across England, Scotland and Wales.
So how can improving our speaking skills be a benefit in our everyday lives?
You could make a better business presentation, give a speech at a wedding, chair a meeting, propose a toast, say what you mean at work, or give a vote of thanks. In fact, make any kind of speech you want. Learning to speak in public is a way of building your personal self-confidence, at work and socially. The greatest result is that you will be able to give a professional account of yourself whenever you are called upon to speak.
Can you tell me about the members of Sudbury Speakers Club?
Speakers clubs are mutual self-help organisations. We have both men and women in our club. Our members come from a broad range of ages, and with very different backgrounds and experiences of life. What we do have in common is that we all started with a fear of public speaking or a wish to improve the speaking skills that we have. We have members with a mix of abilities, all helping to give support, sharing knowledge and offering constructive feedback as we hone our skills. Best of all, we achieve our aims in a relaxed, friendly environment, enjoying the humour that invariably accompanies our learning.
How does someone learn how to improve their public speaking at the club?
We use a 10-stage programme to ensure that all members have the opportunity to develop to the point where they can deliver a masterpiece speech with confidence. The programme is totally flexible so that members can develop at their own pace. Areas we cover include speech construction, use of gestures, using your voice, word pictures, and creating audience rapport. In addition, members have the opportunity to learn the skills involved in impromptu speaking, something that is often overlooked but so valuable in everyday life, for example, in social conversation or at work. Think, for instance, of an interview situation.
So how has joining Speakers Club impacted your life, Kevin?
Prior to joining Sudbury Speakers Club, I was the guy who would go along to a function and sit at the back hoping that no one would speak to me. Now I am very comfortable, indeed enjoy, standing at the front, addressing an audience.
I'm sure there will be amongst our listeners or their family and friends who may feel that they might benefit from visiting your club. Where and when do you meet?
We meet on the third Tuesday evening of each month at the Christopher Centre in Gainsborough Street, Sudbury. Our meetings start at 7 p.m. and we aim to finish at 9 p.m. Please come along to a couple of meetings to see whether you like us. There will be no pressure to join the club and you are free to either take part in the meeting or just sit and listen to what we do. The choice is yours.
Where can we find out more?
We have a website, easc-speakers.co.uk/Sudbury. You can email me, ssc.kn@outlook.com, or telephone me, Kevin Northcott, on 01787 312938.
Thank you, Kevin. That sounds a fantastic club, and it's great that it's done so much for your confidence. Perhaps you might consider joining the News Talk magazine team and contributing to a future edition. Now, that was a little different, wasn't it? I thought I'd bite the bullet and go for a live interview for a change. Is that something you might like us to do again? Perhaps next time we might even take the recording equipment to the guest speaker. Ooh, I'm beginning to think I might have a change of career and become a BBC reporter. Next up, the dulcet tones of Richard Fawcett, our actor friend, who's between shows at the Key Theatre in Sudbury and joins us live in the recording studio. Richard?
Sun, sea and sand, Whitley Bay to a T, or to an S at least. As for sun, I believe that Tynemouth, just round the corner from Whitley Bay, has as much sun as any location in the land, if not more. Sand is the USP of Whitley Bay, long advertised to visitors as having miles and miles of golden sand. As for sea, from the Esplanade you have a clear view for several miles up and down the coast, while in front of you the North Sea stretches to the horizon and beyond to Scandinavia. Before living near the northeast coast, I had lived most of my young life in town, and for seaside I was more familiar with my mother's family's village of Bonus-on-Solway in the northwest. Here we were taken as children to watch the fearsome Solway tide roaring in from the Irish Sea through the narrow channel between Scotland and England, faster than a horse can gallop, and were sternly warned to keep away from it, and away from the open sewer that jutted out into the Solway just upstream of the village. Some there must have been, but I don't recall that it ever figured in our discussions beside the Solway. So, Whitley Bay for news talk, until I realised that Julie's brief envisaged balmy days on sunbeds in the south of France. No matter how many hours of sunlight it might receive, the coast of northeast England can't be confused with the Mediterranean. I needed somewhere else. At some point in the early 50s, my Aunt Jo and Uncle Ed moved to Spain. And one summer we went there on holiday. We headed off to Girona on the rugged coast of the Costa Brava in what was still Franco's Spain. We were certainly not taking the Costa Brava plane, as the song has it, even if there was one. We crossed the channel between New Haven and Dieppe on the car ferry Compiègne, then spent 3 days on the road through France, from which I recall particularly the morning aroma of coffee and croissant in small towns, the vast crenellated structure of medieval Carcassonne, the endless queue of traffic waiting to cross the frontier into Spain, and the unmistakable rise in the temperature and the growing brightness of the sunlit sky. We were aiming for the little fishing village of Palamós, which now may have a more distinctively Catalan name. I am told that it is now much larger, but to me it was simply an idyll of sun, sand, and sea. There was water that lapped gently at the beach just round the corner from the house that was warm enough to swim in, and air warm enough to take evening strolls in light clothes through village lanes. There were beach barbecues featuring gambas cooked in brandy. Trips across the bay with my keen fisherman Uncle Ed in his small boat. Then, in one of the seagoing fishing boats regularly harboured in the village, there was a trip up the coast to Agua Blava with lunch cooked on deck from fish taken that same morning as part of the day's catch. If we didn't eat it on board, we might go down to the fish market later and cook seafood from the same catch on the beach or at home. And then the idyll faded. We drove away one morning through Girona to the frontier and across France by a different route that I mostly forget, but during which the warmth and brightness of the sun perceptibly diminished, and I no longer had the sensation become familiar of warm sand between my toes. Dieppe again, then ferry to New Haven, and a night in Kent with other family members before northwards up the Great North Road, or if you prefer the A1, to home. And the realisation, after we actually moved to Whitley Bay, that seaside for some time to come would be a toss-up between, at best, cloudless blue skies and a cool breeze over miles and miles of golden sand beside a grey North Sea stretching from here to Scandinavia, and at worst, the terrors of a treacherous mix of Solway, Irish Sea, and the upstream open sewer. Although, of course, a bonus, there was always the consolation of Great Aunt Ada's freshly made eggnog at breakfast time.
Thank you, Richard. I could almost see that little fishing village and smell those prawns. You're making me hungry. Now it's time to hear a piece about special places in Suffolk from Joan Head. Let's find out what she loves most about our county.
There are lots of lovely counties in the UK that conjure up beautiful countryside and memories for everyone, but for me it has to be Sudbury. I came to Sudbury when I was in my mid-teens, coming from London in those days, leaving the smog and dirt behind and chimneys that billowed out fumes from the fires, all in close proximity to each other. No wonder the London population was quite poorly, including my mother, who died very young because of the pollution in London. The rush of commuters, that hasn't changed. I so remember getting the school bus because my school was quite a few miles from our house. It was always crowded and I always felt uncomfortable amongst the dreary looking adults. Catching a bus in Sudbury to travel anywhere was such an eye-opener. Firstly, the bus driver would say hello. Well, if a buggy or big bags were being transported, along with a couple of children, he would leave his seat and help. That would never have happened in London, not a chance. The air here was and is so very different. I could smell the fragrances from all around. Even the cow's deposit smelt good to me. To walk across the fields and take in the slow pace of dog walkers, or just plain walkers, enjoying the beautiful countryside. It was all very new to me, and to this day I am so appreciative of my surroundings. When I arrived in Sudbury, the population was around 11,000. Now it's in the 40s. The traffic has obviously continued to grow along with the population, not just from the Sudbury natives, but like me, have come to have a better life. My father remarried a Sudbury lady and I came here for the first time and remember clearly walking down the quaint steps of Sudbury railway station, thinking how pleasant, even had plants. The overspill from the city here was not greeted with great desire, but after umpteen years, I think the new population has fitted in. Now, second and third generations, they surely are Sudbury people. I married a Lavenham man and raised three daughters here. All went off to university and one went around the world for a year, but have all come back to Suffolk. My youngest daughter went to a very large London hospital to do her training, but she decided she didn't want her children brought up in the city. She came back here to stay, along with her London Irish partner. He loves Sudbury and I can never see them moving anywhere else. I consider this my home, not London, remembering the people as you walked around the tiny town who would say good morning or just hello. This was unheard of in the city. In fact, you would probably have been locked up for being familiar. It took a lot of adjustment for me. I missed the big shops and jumping on or off the bus any time because they just came along all the time. Here it was a bus timetable and a train timetable. That in itself was quite alien to me. I remarried 15 years ago after losing my husband 24 years ago. Alan is a country boy and has always appreciated the countryside, having grown up in East Sussex and as an adult North Wales for around 3 years for work. Often we go to Snape or Aldborough for the day. Coming back, we may stop off somewhere in a village and have a bite to eat, but always we get talking to people around. That's part of Suffolk life. I hope that never stops. There are lots of lovely places and gardens open to the public, all within a short driving distance from Sudbury. If we have to go further afield for larger shops, how fortunate we are living in the middle of Colchester, Bury St Edmunds and Ipswich. Always a good shopping centres. Not so nowadays, Ipswich, unfortunately. I have a lovely garden and we like to spend time doing things, changing plants, cutting back. We also grow veggies. That was rare in London. I can never remember that as a child. Our garden was the size of a postage stamp. We didn't even have furniture in it. Having said that, I don't think we used to have cow gardens for that purpose anyway. We frequently go away and always on our return journey, we both sigh and say, oh, it will be good to be home to Sudbury. I don't think I would want to live anywhere else.
Thank you for sharing that story with us, Joan. I'm inclined to agree with you. I've lived in Sudbury for just over 2 years now and love it. You mentioned about being able to jump on a bus any time when you lived in London. Well, it's not quite that good in Suffolk, but did you know that Chambers have recently introduced an evening and Sunday service on the 753, the Sudbury to Bury St Edmunds bus? We all love Toby Jacobs' contributions, and he's given this one a lot of thought. Although not strictly sun, sea and sand, it's near enough. Read by my favourite person in the whole world, my husband Steve Thompson, let's hear about Toby's fun in the sun, messing about in boats.
Southwest London is not noted for its waterways. Apart from the River Wandle, which is about 6 foot wide and 2 deep, you could say that it's pretty well landlocked. So how does one explain why I've always been fascinated by water, in particular canals? The nearest such waterway would have to be the Regent's Canal in central London, but that's a good 8 miles away from my childhood neighbourhood. Yet, from an early age, I've loved narrow boats and their associated culture. Perhaps it was the mystery of these often hidden ribbons of life that ploughed their own furrow through the back door of many an industrial town. Could it have been the brightly painted boats and skillful sign writing? Or was I just attracted to life at 4 miles per hour? Let's take a trip along the Cut, as it's known, to try and answer some of these aquatic conundrums and arrive at the present day where interest in these old waterways has never been greater. Camden Town on the edge of North London could be described using many an adjective, but let's just say it's colourful and leave it at that. Home to the world-famous Camden Market, its position on the Regent's Canal is often overlooked by those searching out a retail bargain or two. However, one sunny Sunday morning, my parents and I set off from deepest suburbia to ride the Jenny Wren trip boat, based at Camden Lock. One of the markets is actually called the Stables, after the area where the horses were kept for towing. This was in the days before the internal combustion engine. However, we weren't interested in Dr. Martin boots or vintage jeans, just a leisurely amble along one of London's few inland waterways. After we paid our money at the ticket booth, we were ushered through a door and down some stairs. The sound of the busy road all but disappeared, and we found ourselves standing on the towpath of a thin green canal. It was like we'd entered a portal and left modern life behind and arrived back 100 years earlier. People who enjoy inland waterways often say that the attraction is due to them occupying a hidden netherworld, and this was certainly the case here. We boarded the Jenny Wren and set off westwards. Our first encounter was the Hampstead Road Lock, situated right next to the busy market. This meant that there were many gongoozlers about. This is a boating term for the people on the bank who like to watch canal activity. It just so happened that Camden's selection certainly looked like they'd enjoyed a shandy or two. As we progressed along, it soon became apparent that we were seeing a very different view of London than that seen from a car or bus. Secret gardens, alleyways, and the backs of old houses betrayed the age of the city, often masked by more traditional facades to the front. One building was soon to become the home to the breakfast television programme TVAM. The close proximity to the towpath makes narrow boating all the more interesting, as it provides an artery for joggers, cyclists and walkers. Mutual observation ensues, with them looking at you and vice versa. Eventually we came to the point where the back of London Zoo appeared. The large bird aviary contained all manners of species and looked like a giant mountainous net with its peaks and troughs. Upon reaching a wider section, the boat was deftly turned round and we headed for home. Fast forward 15 years, and my then girlfriend and I were looking for adventure. I suggested riding our bicycles to Little Venice from Victoria Station and following the Regent's Canal eastward to Camden. I hadn't been there since the trip mentioned previously. So there we were, the two of us, riding up the Edgware Road on our bikes, looking for Blomfield Road West 4. This was the road nearest the canal, and is one of London's swankiest addresses, most notably because of its picturesque narrowboats and permanently moored there. Hence the nickname Little Venice. Eventually we spotted our destination and pulled off the busy road into a scene of complete tranquility and calm. The multicoloured vessels reminded me of a sweet shop, with brightly painted reds, yellows and greens contrasting against the uniformity of the white painted stucco houses nearby. One good thing about following a canal is that it's almost impossible to get lost. We just pointed our bikes towards Camden and off we went. As we cycled ever onwards, a trip boat approached, and I wondered if it might be the Jenny Wren from yesteryear, but it wasn't. However, the passengers seemed as enamoured with the experience as I remember being. They looked at us and we at them. Before we knew it, we were at London Zoo, looking at the familiar bird aviary of my memory. We were just a couple of gongoozlers enjoying life at 4 miles per hour.
Thank you to Toby for writing and Steve for reading. It's got me wondering how we might get our bicycles up to London for a scenic ride alongside that canal. Let's welcome back Michelle now with the answers to the quiz.
Hello. Being an Ipswich Town supporter, the young man arrived in a tractor, of course, which his mum had hired especially for the occasion. And I just thought, I enjoyed that story so much, I wanted to include it somehow. 2. According to the old proverb, one swallow does not a summer make. So that's a swallow. 3. Billy Butlin opened his first holiday camp in Skegness, where the air really is bracing. 4. Cucumber is an incredible 96% water, which is why it's so refreshing in the summer salads. And 5. Like the tomato, cucumber is also a vegetable. 6. Dodie Smith and 101 Dalmatians link Sudbury with Walt Disney and Hollywood. The author of both 101 Dalmatians and The Secret Garden lived relatively nearby in Finchingfield and used to come to Sudbury to do her shopping and banking, apparently. It was, of course, 101 Dalmatians made into just a wonderful film for children. 7. Sudbury Rowing Club is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. 8. I was very surprised to learn that the 2024 Olympic surfing event will take place in Tahiti. Tahiti is in French Polynesia, which is semi-autonomous and therefore connected to France. 9. Tree plantations of Salix alba, that's white willow, that line many riverbanks in East Anglia, supply wood for cricket bats. They're harvested at around 12 to 20 years old, and it's the size that determines when they're ready. Each tree can make around 40 bats, apparently. And 10, in the right hands, slices of bread, sugar and berries make a delicious summer pudding.
Thank you, Michelle. I didn't get all of those right. How about you at home? Well, I think that's what they call a wrap. So thank you, lovely listeners, for giving us your full attention. And we hope you've liked what you've heard. Why not take a moment to let us know by slipping a note in your return envelope? While you're at it, why not include some suggestions for a guest, an idea for a topic, or just to let us know what we could do differently to make your listening experience more enjoyable After all, it's you we're aiming to please. We hope that before our next edition, you'll get to enjoy some warmer and sunnier weather that will lift your spirits and fill the air with buzzing insects, the fragrance of flowers, and the sound of combine harvesters. Thank you to all the contributors to Edition 236, including Dave Sullivan, our sound engineer this time, and not forgetting those behind the scenes and the generous folks that donate to our charity, Sudbury News Talk. So from the News Talk team and me, Julie Thompson, until next time, goodbye.
Bye.